The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of the best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, Professor Peter Wilson and presenter Ella McSweeney join me to tell me about their new series, How Animals Work, which does exactly as it says on the tin and shows how animals work through the medium of dissection. So maybe avoid having your dinner beforehand if you're watching it. Family therapist Brian O'Sullivan came in to discuss parental alienation, how it occurs and what can be done about it. Brendan Doyle is aiming to be Ireland's first skeleton bobsleigh Olympic champion. This wasn't what he thought he was going to do with his life, but a terrible ordeal and subsequent mental health problems caused him to leave the job he loved and pursue something different. He shared his story. The Northern Channel is freezing and full of lion's manes, jellyfish and killer whales. So obviously Rachel Lee, along with her husband and another teammate, decided to swim it and break all world records in the process. A delighted Rachel told me about their wondrous feat. And Sarah O'Neill will graduate with a first-class honours degree from DCU in November, an achievement by any standards, but particularly when you consider she was diagnosed with cancer at the age of 17. She popped in and impressed us with her mature and upbeat attitude. So that's it. I hope you enjoy. Until the next time, thanks for listening. Welcome back to the programme. Now, ahead of, if you are watching Love Island tonight, I suggest that you flick over to RTE1 at 8:30 this evening, because there is a brand new and fascinating four-part series that starts tonight. It's called How Animals Work. Ella McSweeney will introduce us to various fascinating aspects of animals in Ireland, and Professor Peter Wilson will be dissecting a similar animal in front of a live studio audience to show the viewer something very interesting about the animal's biology. It starts this evening, like I say, and Ella and Peter are in the studio with me now. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
And
good
thank
morning.
You very much. Co-presenters on a TV show, but former teacher and students.
That's correct.
We should point out. We should point out who was the teacher and who was the student.
I'm afraid
he
I was
learned
the
so
teacher.
Much from me. Yeah, in zoology, yeah. In Trinity, Trinity, and many years ago, and yeah. I never thought that I would have the privilege of standing next to him in presenting a TV program on zoology as well. So it's great.
So great fun. I managed to watch tonight's episode. I had a little sneak preview of it, and it's absolutely fascinating. I wouldn't say that you have to have a strong stomach necessarily, but there's a bit of the dissection, Peter, that's quite, you are a little bit unexpected, actually, by something that you come across when you're dissecting a lizard.
Yes, I wasn't expecting to find eggs in the cavity of the lizard at all, and I found them interesting. But of course, this was a lizard that was kept as somebody's pet that unfortunately died. Mm. So, like all exotic animals, we tend to deep freeze them because, in case they might be used as a teaching tool later on. Mm. And as I opened the abdomen of the lizard, there to my amazement, were a whole set of eggs getting ready to be laid.
Incredible, really. Yeah. And I mean, you know, you've been working in this area for many, many years, I suppose. Had you dissected a lizard before?
No, I hadn't dissected that species of lizard before, no.
So, like, that must have been incredible for you, because, like, you would think that, I suppose, you've learned everything, that you must know everything there is to know at this stage
of
your
career.
Oh,
no, I certainly don't know everything that is to be known. I know a little bit about certain things. The animal world, the biological, is immense, and we don't understand the half of what's going on.
And why is dissecting animals then so important, I suppose, and why does it sort of, you know, show us stuff that we mightn't have known before about that particular species?
Well, because it's how an animal works. I remember as a 5-year-old saying to my mother, I was having grass for tea like the cow in the field. So I had a big plate of grass and she said, "We'd like salad cream." I said, "You'd be silly. Cows don't have salad cream." But I didn't get on very well with the grass as the family ran were having their normal tea. And of course, I was just explained to me, "Well, you don't have a stomach like a cow." And I said, "Why don't I have a stomach like a cow?" And that got me interested in how animals work. And for instance, I must have been an awful youngster because I noticed that the poo that cows produce is very different than the poo that a horse produces. But of course, they both eat grass and hay. And I couldn't understand that until later in life when I understood that, of course, hindgut fermenters like horses are very different from ruminants like cows. Horses are nothing like as efficient as cows.
But also, like, the insides of animals and humans used to be a sacrosanct mystery. I mean, it used to just be something that we'd invent stories about until you sort of saw scientists and researchers and people, the equivalent of Peter, who were very, very sort of curious, open them up and start to say, right, let's kind of understand these things and bust all the myths. And even if you think of someone like Charles Darwin, who spent, you know, years and years obsessed about barnacles, obsessed about earthworms, you know, spent a lot of time dissecting animals to really understand why it is that they behave in the way they do, why it is that they are, you know, individual species. And that, of course, led to his amazing book, The Origin of the Species. So you have an amazing history to dissection, which is all about curiosity and finding fact.
We will actually point out at this point in the conversation that, and you mentioned that the lizard was a pet that had unfortunately died. People will, because there's a lot of dissections across the series, lots of different animals, including a horse later in the series. Yes. People will be curious to know where the animals were sourced from for the programme.
No animal was killed specifically at all. For example, I dissect a hen, which the students fascinate. But as you broiler hens and chickens producing eggs, they come to the end of their economic life. And they're sold for pet food. They're culled and sold for pet food. We just tap into that system and get some of the dead animals and dissect them. And when you show students where eggs come from, they're absolutely astonished.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing, actually. It's just incredible. Ella, Peter mentioned there when he was five and wanted to know about grass eating. Where did your love of animals come from? Where did it start, do you think? Can you remember back?
I don't have any strong memory of asking my mum, can I eat a plate of grass? But I suppose I've always just had a huge interest in the natural world. Along with most children, I think, there is a kind of natural inclination to be really interested in what goes on in the wood or whatever, you know. So I think I've always just had that and found myself very drawn to wildlife, very drawn to farm animals as well, and just was lucky enough to be able to study zoology, which I would recommend to anyone as one of the best things you can study, because you can jump into any career from zoology. It's just a whole world of fascination, and I think it's great that we're kind of trying to bring this to the general audience tonight.
You're in the RT Guide as well, actually, this week. Lovely interview in this week's RT Guide, Ella. And you mentioned that, of course, you actually wanted to, you were more interested in farming, and that you were sort of told at the time, well, it's not really a job for a girl.
I think that's easily explained. You know, I mean, it is. I mean, I'm not that old, but it's certainly only more recently that, you know, you will have seen it being much more straightforward and acceptable that women would be the lead farmer on a farm. So I think that kind of change is really good. And I think most vast majority of farmers I talk to see that as a really, really positive thing. And the more women who are farming, the better. I find it's really interesting to see the difference in the way that women and men farm. But, you know, it was also, I'm not from a farm. And at that stage, when I wanted to study agriculture, I wasn't intending to marry a farmer. I was only 17. So, you know, all those things are explainable. I'm actually really glad I ended up doing zoology instead of agriculture, but I've managed to kind of meld the two together, which is great.
We talked there about, you know, the mindset of kids, and you mentioned how children are always really interested in animals, and particularly, you know, the lizards and the different kind of animals. And I just wonder, and you mentioned there that students are always fascinated to find out where eggs come from, Peter. Do we miss something along the way? Do we lose that sort of fascination, do you think, as children? Because is there a kind of a disjoint between us loving animals and yet not quite understanding the food chain as well, you know, just as yes, the way I we mean, shop and
I
the
mean,
way we
you see eggs on the supermarket shelf, but you really know where they come from. And when I can show them a hen's ovary and the ova being produced and the ova descending the reproductive tract and the albumen being added, which is the white, and then, of course, the shell being added, and then the female lays the egg. And you think about it, that's not just happening in hens, it's happening in all the birds. And I'm fascinated that blue tits, for example, which we all love to see in our bird tables, they have a terrific calcium demand because they lay lots of eggs and their body size is very small. How do they meet that calcium demand? In the hen, it gets it in the food. But the blue tits use the snail shells, the common snail shells, which is, of course, calcium phosphate, and they use that to boost the calcium requirement when they're getting ready to lay a big clutch. That's fantastic. Mm. And it's those sort of details that I found, still do find absolutely fascinating.
And it's all about observation then, because once you know these things, then you begin to see them. You know, if you don't understand these things, you don't see it. But once, as Peter was saying about the blue tit, it's incredible then once you witness that. Even just details about barn owls, we do pieces on barn owls and the eel. These are all species that are really, really endangered in Ireland. And to, you know, to hear Peter talk about them and dissect them and give an understanding into their insides, I find it just utterly fascinating.
Does it sadden you that these kind of animals are endangered?
Of course it does. But I don't know what the solution to the problem is, far less humans. And that's a problem where I don't think we're ever going to solve. So, I mean, that's where the role of zoos come in. They can ensure that many species will survive in zoos. Hopefully, if we ever get sensibly wild as possible again, we can reintroduce them back to the wild. But the main thing is to have self-sustaining populations of animals in zoos. It's very sad to think that gorillas will be extinct in the wild in our lifetime. I felt humbled as a zoo director standing in the presence of some of these magnificent animals like a gorilla or a giraffe. We've got to do something to keep them for future generations.
And even in Ireland, like I was in the Natural History Museum a few days ago and you saw bird species like the nightjar, which is all but extinct in Ireland. And, you know, I was there with my two-year-old and you're thinking, you know, what are the species when she is 20 that you're going to see that actually don't exist here anymore? But then the good side is you have amazing people around the country who really are trying to make a difference. People like Donal Sheehan, who's a farmer down in Cork. You know, all these farmers who are really coming on board, trying to farm in a more wildlife-friendly way. And I think that the more we can get of that energy, the more you will see the kind of positive results from that, certainly with things like barn owls, for example. You know, there's a lot that we can do quickly that will really make a difference, and that's a really positive thing.
And do you think that are we at a time where the tide is turning, just in general, I suppose, when it comes to even, you know, climate action and looking after our environment and understanding and people, you know, maybe letting a little bit of their garden grow wild so that they'll attract insects and
I hope
bumblebees.
We are at the turn. Life is changing. I mean,
young
climate,
people are making their voice heard.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, changing climate is concerning everybody now. What's going to happen? And I think that if you're concerned about climate change and all the things that may happen to the wildlife, that's great. And I just hope that we can be responsible and take the necessary action.
Do you love teaching people about animals? Is it something that, because you've your career has changed a little bit, hasn't it? Because
yes.
You were at Dublin Zoo and then you became a teacher.
I was, remember the vet school before that, at the Trinity Veterinary School before that. So I was teaching veterinary students then. I enjoy imparting information that excites me to anybody, because I feel if somebody doesn't understand it, they're missing out on something. And I mean, to be able to show, for example, the gizzard of a bird, and that has stones in it. Why does it have stones in it? Because, of course, a bird has no teeth. It's got to break up its food to make it an efficient digester. So no matter what bird species you look at, all the gizzards have stones, and the muscles of the gizzard contract and grind the stones against the food. So that's what breaks the food down to make digestion more efficient. I think that's great. But when you show that to students, stones in a gizzard, they can't believe that.
But we filmed it in front of a live audience. And it was interesting.
The faces on some of the audience members,
you know,
definitely mirror. I think when it came to the lizard in particular, I was kind of a bit like, oh, you know.
My advice is you breathe through the strong dissection scenes and you realise how fascinating it is. But Peter is such a natural performer and so comfortable
Absolutely.
In front of, you know, the live audience that we had. And it was great to have them, for Peter to bounce off as well. But you could see their reactions. And the vast majority of them were just wanting more. When we finished filming, they wanted more. Mm-hmm. You know, it was great.
What was your favourite dissection? Could I say that? Was there a favourite?
A trout.
Well, I don't know that I have a favourite dissection. Every dissection opens a mystery as far as I'm concerned. And I suppose the one that most impresses the people looking at it, it perhaps is the hen, where they are used to having an egg for breakfast and boiling it. And so they've never thought about where it comes from. And they see the ovary of the hen and the embryo and so on descending the hen's reproductive tract. They never thought about it like that. And I think that's interesting. In the same way, as I said, the gizzard has stones in it. They never thought about it like that. So it's to see, the fun is to getting people to suddenly, oh, is that what happens?
One of the other very interesting and kind of almost like, is this actually happening while I was watching it, was the snake and milking the fangs of the snake. That was amazing. So it's not all about dead animals, we should point out, because there are live animals as well. And this snake was just, I mean, it was incredible footage. And doing that in front of the live audience, again, they looked really shocked at this. What was the purpose of that, Ella?
Well, I suppose we're just showing how you can get venom out of a snake, and it was done in a very, very careful way, because obviously the priority with everything we did was to make sure that the animals were okay. But yeah, it's really interesting. And actually, scientists now are looking at venom as a potential source of antibiotics in the future because of the problem about antibiotic resistance. So there's a whole world of sort of science behind it as well. But yeah, the audience were a little bit
annoyed. As well.
Yes,
so
and
that
of course,
if somebody is bitten,
yeah.
you've got to have developed yeah. methods of mm-hmm. treatment and so on mm-hmm. for people who are bitten. And we don't have snakes in Ireland. And it's not thanks to St. Patrick, incidentally. It's a continental drift and all sorts of stories. But I mean, people are horrified by snakes. They're horrified by eels. Anything long and slimy, they seem to have a natural horror. Snakes are lovely.
Snakes
they're warm.
Are amazing.
They're gorgeous. Yeah, yeah. But people don't understand that.
Yeah, being no, so close to them
you're,
was phenomenal.
You're not convincing me, I'm sorry. I understand what you're saying, but I can't. Yeah, I've held a snake before and I was a bit, yeah, it wasn't crazy. But I held a lizard as well, actually. And they're incredible because they're... Their bellies are really warm and actually their skin is quite lovely.
Yeah, well, they're ectotherms. They take up the temperature of the environment around them. People don't understand that. A snake won't be warm. If little Johnny has a pet snake and is not feeding and is in a little box in his bedroom, if it's cold, he's not going to do well at all. But the great thing is, if little Johnny's snake escapes and mummy's very worried about where the snake is, what you do is turn up the heating in the hot press as high as you can and open the door, and within a very short time little
later.
Johnny Snake will be back in for the heat. They find the heat source.
And we've had a few texts in here. This one, Maggie, can you ask Peter and Ella what kind of careers can one follow from studying zoology?
I mean, well, I work in the media and I know obviously a lot of my friends, one of them has gone into ecological consultancy. Another one is the head, Lynn Scarf, who's the head of the National Museum, working in fisheries. I mean, I think it's a great overall kind of starting point for anyone who's interested in science. But what are the other...
Well, animals are indicators of how good the environment is. So if the environment's in trouble, they can look at the animals and see why they're in trouble, and then they can start to sort out how to sort that problem out. Mm. And I think that's one of the major roles of zoologists in the world, to sort out why we're poisoning our climate, why we're damaging our habitats.
And as you said, Peter, of course, earlier, you know, it's very important that we try and make sure that we don't lose species, and actually, and zoos have a very important place in that. Some people would be quite concerned at seeing animals in cages or behind...
Well, of course, we've been trying to get rid of the image of cages all along. Mm-hmm. But when I started to work in the zoo in 1984, the concept of an endangered species almost wasn't understood amongst the public at all. Now they can begin to see what's happening and the role of the zoos. And, of course, we would like to put them back into the wild, and that happens if the wild is stable. But the main thing is to keep those species... And all zoo animals now are born and bred in zoos. They've not come from the wild. They're not captured from the wild. So you've created an environment for them to live in a zoo.
We've had a lovely tweet in, actually, from somebody who says, just back from Uganda, Bwindi Park, which harbours half of the gorilla population, they've increased from 1,313 in 1993 to 15,112 last year. That's incredible, isn't it?
I don't know about those figures, I'm afraid. Yeah.
And then this from Eileen. Our niece studied zoology. She worked with animals in South Africa, Ethiopia, Guyana, and now going to Spain. Her family and herself have a wonderful life, says Eileen. So there you go.
There you go.
Somebody very happy in the job. It's fantastic. Like I say, I managed to get the first episode, a little sneak preview, and it is really, really good. You don't have to have a particularly strong stomach to watch it because it's actually fascinating.
Kids will particularly love it.
Kids will absolutely love it. And it's on at a great time as well, because they don't have to get up for school tomorrow morning. It's on at 8:30 tonight on RTE1, presented by Ella McSweeney and the very eminent Professor Peter Wilson from Trinity College Dublin. Thank you so much for coming in to chat to us this morning, and we look forward to it. It's a four-parter, Ella, is that
it
right?
It is a four-parter.
Excellent.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So yeah, it's all about the lizard tonight and those snake fangs. Thank you so much. Lovely to have you in. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back after this. We got an email into the programme a couple of weeks ago from a dad who hasn't been able to see his children for a few months. And he wanted to highlight the issue of parental alienation, which actually was recently included in the new international classification of diseases under the World Health Organization, the WHO. Now, it's a condition which my next guest, as a systemic family therapist, is all too familiar with. Brian O'Sullivan, you're very welcome to the programme. Thanks for coming in this morning.
Maggie, good morning to you and your listeners.
Now, look, just explain to us, I suppose we've got the brief of it there, really, from, you know, what I described it as, that, you know, not being able to see the kids. But what exactly is parental alienation?
It's a good question, Maggie. So what we know very clearly is that's a relational phenomenon. It's said to occur most often in the context of high conflict separations and divorces. And really what happens is a child will align very strongly with one parent and then will reject the previously loved parent without legitimate justification. But I suppose one important point to mention there is that this happens to mums and dads.
Okay. Does it ever happen in a situation where there isn't a separation or divorce?
It's a good point, Maggie. So yes, for sure. I mean, the literature is quite clear. It can happen in that context. But the focus of my, I suppose, practice, research and publications is purely in the context of separations and divorces.
And what sort of age are we talking about? Does it happen? Can it happen at any age to children?
Yeah, again, a good point, Maggie. It can happen at any age. Very often when a child will hit 7 years of age onwards is when we see, I suppose, that it's most devastating. But for sure, I mean, I've met with children who are 5 and 6 years of age who will present as having been subjected to alienating behaviours by one parent.
And why is it that the World Health Organization has decided to actually classify it now? I mean, why wasn't it classified before?
So I suppose it's like everything else. The ICD-11 is an emerging document. Every couple of years, they review and revise a variety of medical and relational phenomena.
This is the ICD International Classification of Diseases.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so every 5 years or so, they review it, which is a healthy thing, much like the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Currently in its 5th edition and from 2013, they too revise about every 5 years or so. And so really what's happened is that there's been a body of literature, empirical literature, that it's a tsunami of empirical literature that has come along and said, you know, this is a problem and it needs to be addressed.
You mentioned there that it's the child alienating a parent. So this is a problem that children will have. It's not something that goes two ways as such, is it?
So I suppose, well, again, an interesting point, Maggie. Mm. So I suppose, I mean, first of all, we'll have a child who is being subjected to what we call alienating behaviours. What does that look like? Well, essentially, we will have one parent who will be profoundly denigrating the other parent in front of the child. Along with a variety of other behaviours. In fact, the full list is on parentalnation.eu if people are interested. And the child is essentially placed into a loyalty conflict or a double bind where there's no good choice for the child. And so the child will, as a result of that, the child will essentially align with one parent and reject the other previously loved parent. And the difficulty is that we know very, very clearly that this has a sustained and enduring psychological and emotional impact on the child. Not just now, but across their lifespan and on into future generations.
What sort of impact? I mean, if a child is starting, if parental alienation is part of the behaviour from a child who's 8, 9, or 10 or whatever, how long can it last? If it's not fixed, I suppose.
Yes, that's a key piece, because some well-meaning and well-intentioned professionals will hold an idea that this is a normal transient piece for parents who are separating and divorcing. But actually, informed practitioners know very well that when relationships are fractured in this way, the possibility of a spontaneous reconciliation is really rather remote. And it doesn't bear out in the clinical and academic literature.
And how important is it for kids who are involved in a breakdown with the parents and going through a divorce or a separation? How important is it for them, for both parents to be, I suppose, working together and for it not to be one or the other?
Yeah, so, I mean, we know very, very clearly that children's outcomes are optimal when they have a quality relationship with both parents, which just brings me to one side point, and that this isn't about mum's rights, it's not about dad's rights, it's about the rights of a child to have a quality relationship with both parents. I suppose maybe then just to reference back to some of the specific harms that we know occurs with children. And so what we have is very, very clearly with clinical depression, anxiety, fractured relationships, dysfunctional attachments, alcohol abuse, substance abuse, suicidal ideation, deliberate self-harming behaviours, academic underachievement, premature sexual activity, And the list goes on and on.
That's a fairly exhaustive list, yes. Brian. And I suppose then, as a child grows up and becomes an adult and potentially suffers from any of those things, then if they go on to have children themselves, does it then impact on their relationship with their children?
It's absolutely key point, Maggie, because we know very, very clearly that these dynamics transcend generations of families. And so what we have then is the future generations and children in those future generations experiencing the very same significant psychological and emotional harms. And I suppose it brings me to one point, maybe, that we do need to be very, very clear that this is psychological and emotional abuse of children. It needs to be viewed that way, and it needs to be responded to like we would respond to other forms of abuse in children.
It must be incredibly difficult obviously for children, but also, I suppose, for parents when they're going through a separation and a breakup and potentially divorce, especially if something has happened, I'm thinking of an affair or whatever it might be, that then creates, you know, or just generally feeling abandoned, I suppose, if a parent just decides to walk away from a relationship in the family home. It must be incredibly difficult then for them to, I suppose, keep focused and not be negative about the other parent.
For sure. So I suppose the key piece there, Maggie, that you're alluding to is that there are reasons why children will reject a parent for normative reasons. Perhaps maybe a parent has been abusive or neglectful to the child. And in those cases, we refer to that as justified estrangement. And in that space, there can never be alienation.
Okay, but what about then when it's when say one parent feels abandoned or is under pressure, or maybe the other parent has had an affair or whatever it might be. Yeah. And then it must be very difficult for that parent who's left there not to be negative and therefore, you know, not to pass on the negative feelings to the child.
For sure, it can be a challenge, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, mums and dads are humans first. And when we get consumed by conflict, it can be really, really difficult to place the needs of the children ahead of our own at those times. But with the proper supports and resources and with early intervention, it is entirely possible to do that.
A couple of people are getting in touch with us this morning, Brian. On email, I want to remain anonymous, of course, absolutely. And you can do if you want to get in touch with us. Our text number, we're speaking to Brian O'Sullivan, consultant, systemic family therapist and expert in parental alienation. 51551, you can email ryan@rte.ie. So this person says, I had a super relationship with my two children. Since my ex and I broke up in 2013, I've been constantly in and out of court trying to get reasonable access to them. During this time, there have been numerous allegations made against me by their mother. Unfortunately, last year, they went to an all-time low when she falsely reported me for sexually abusing our own child. I was devastated and still am. I haven't seen my children since. I was eventually cleared of these allegations only 3 weeks ago, but I went through absolute hell. I can only imagine what the children are going through. If I hadn't the great support of my current wife, family and good friends, I'm not sure I would be here today. When these types of allegations are made, you are immediately assumed guilty and contact is cut. It is ideal for an alienating parent and gives them more time to make the situation worse. Very difficult, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. And I suppose there's a couple of points just to make there. The first one, I suppose, is that the levelling of allegations, both mums and dads do this. We know very clearly that dads will typically allege physical abuse or neglect, and mums will typically allege sexual abuse. And of course, naturally enough, when allegations like that are levelled, services and agencies have to privilege the welfare of children and ensure the veracity or otherwise of these allegations. However, the challenge is that when one parent will allege allegations of abuse against another, it becomes a very successful strategy because, naturally enough, the contact then between the child and the targeted parent is terminated. And that unwittingly actually perpetuates the alienation. And just to make one more point in relation to that is that informed practitioners will know very, very well that in cases of alienation, allegations of abuse are false. And it occurs in up to 70 to 80% of cases of alienation.
That's a huge amount. I was going to say, do we have any idea of how many false allegations are made? Up to 70 to 80% of those cases.
In cases of high conflict, divorce and separation, where alienation has been affirmed.
It's incredible.
It is 70 to 80%.
It's actually frightening, I think, that a parent would do that to their children. Because as you said, I suppose that in itself is also a form of abuse.
Yes.
Is there any follow-on then to you know, with regard to the authorities when the other parent makes that false allegation against another parent? I mean, legally.
Yes. So, well, I suppose, first of all, let me say I'm not a legal person, but No, I mean, if you have a parent who will allege false allegations against another parent, there are no consequences, as I understand it, for that parent. And one of the real tragedies in this is that the children end up being interviewed multiple times by multiple agencies. So, for example, they may be subjected to multiple interviews by Gardaí, by social workers, by perhaps maybe St Clair's unit in Temple Street, and so on and so forth. And in those cases, we are very much at the severe end of the spectrum. And what's required in those cases is very firm and proactive decisions by and a collaboration by the judiciary and the mental health professionals to effect change that privileges the children's psychological and emotional health.
Because that must be very, very traumatic for children to have to go through.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We've had an email in here. Thanks for addressing the topic of parental alienation, as it is widely ignored in the media and by politicians, as it only affects a small group of people. I've not seen my eldest daughter for over a year and a half following the breakdown of my marriage. The only reason this happened is that my ex is preventing me from seeing my daughter. This is a complex issue involving hidden psychological illness that the legal and child protection systems are not equipped to deal with. The government must legislate to prevent one parent alienating a child from the other. This is not a gender issue. It happens to both fathers and mothers.
Absolutely. And in my own clinical practice in Stillorgan, over the last 4 years or so, I've seen very, very clearly there are thousands of mothers in this country who are experiencing this phenomenon. And there is a piece or an idea, there may be an idea that while this might be expected to be something that happens to men, mums, Irish mums going through this are silent. They have no voice in this.
Why is that?
It's almost... as horrendous as it is for dads, there seems to be an added stigma for a mum where she's faced with a child who is rejecting her without good reason. And in terms of the amount of time it may have been that that particular emailer has referenced, I mean, I see very, very clearly, I work with parents all the time who haven't seen their children in 6, 8, 10, 12 years for no good reason.
And well, as we mentioned before, the damage is then, I mean, the relationship. I mean, can relationships be repaired after that amount of time?
They can be. And the ideas around systemic family psychotherapy have a unique contribution to that. There are specialised family therapy programmes that focus exclusively on reconciling the child-parent relationship. Informed practitioners will know very, very well that children do hold and harbour the warm, loving feelings that they have towards a parent. And it's simply a matter of extricating them from their loyalty conflict or double bind. And then organically the relationship will flourish as it did in the past.
A text in here from a mum. I'm a mum of two girls that I haven't seen in 2 months. I had a wonderful relationship with my girls that has been destroyed by their dad. They want no contact with me and accuse me of abusing them physically, which never happened. That's very difficult to hear, isn't it? Also another text. I went through parental alienation in 2005. I'm a mother. Solicitors need to get a better understanding of this. Just one piece of advice. Keep on letting your children know how much you want to be with them and love them. It will help them later on when they are older. Glad to see this is finally coming to the airwaves. Is that something, Brian, that I mean, how long have you been working in this particular field with parental alienation?
Sure.
Has it always had this term?
So I suppose, well, yes. Mm. I mean, it is parental alienation is an umbrella term. I personally have been in this space, or professionally been in this space since 1999. And I suppose it was my work with young people and families. And then, of course, my thesis, where I explored the lived experiences of alienated parents here in Ireland,
okay.
Mums and dads navigating this, I suppose really brought it to the fore for me.
Ask your guest, Maggie, how do you divide time equally between parents for the good of the child and their education and mental health?
So that's a really interesting question, because I suppose there's an awful lot, there's a couple of different factors there that need to be taken into consideration. The first point to make is that each case is probably largely unique. So sometimes, for a simple example would be there can be geographical considerations of where parents live. You know, if one parent is living 300 miles away from another, well, that's going to inform a particular concept. However, the emerging literature is telling us that in an ideal world, it would be 50-50 contact, or a presumption of 50-50 contact between parents who split. Now, as I say, there are a number of reasons that can impact on that, one of them being geographical, along with the ideas around the parental alienation phenomenon.
And also, I suppose, wherever the parent who isn't in the homestead anymore, where that parent is, and whether or not they've got the facilities, I suppose, to have the kids stay over or whatever it might be. Yeah. Maggie, can you give the details of the website again? They missed it. I think that was it a .eu website?
That's right. Brian? So it's a platform, parentalalienation.eu. It's a platform that I've recently set up. Its aim is to create awareness, education and interventions for both professionals and parents, both here in Ireland and throughout Europe.
Somebody else has texted in, Brian. I'm in the middle of parental alienation at the moment. Can you ask Brian, can it be reversed or even begin to be undone when there's no change in the parent's behaviour? What should this parent be doing now?
Okay, so there's a number of different pieces that parent can do. The first thing is that parent needs to become incredibly well informed around the dynamics of parental alienation. That parent needs to engage with professionals, informed professionals and practitioners, legal, social and mental health, to effect tangible change. When we're at the severe end of the spectrum, we are dealing with a parent who is pathologically determined to erase the child from that parent's life. And tragically, what also happens is that the child is erased from the entire one half of a family. So grandparents, which is never spoken about either. Grandparents are alienated. A child will present and decide that they never want to speak or meet with a granny or grandmother ever again. And interestingly, I'm reminded of a particular, a recent case where a 9 and 10 year old presented to me and said to me, I never want to see my granny and grandmother ever again. And when we explored that a bit further with them, they said to me, well, they spoil us and it's not good for grandparents to spoil children.
Wow. So where did they hear that?
Exactly. Yeah. And that brings us to the point where actually it is incredibly easy. Once we're informed, it's incredibly easy to identify the dynamics of parental alienation in a family.
What do you do then though with that information? I'm just wondering about that particular case. Yeah. So do you go to the parents and say, don't be so silly?
So again,
spoiling is fine.
Yes. So again, when we're at the severe end of the spectrum, I often become involved in the context of family law proceedings. And in those cases, you're reporting back to the court. And you're into, I suppose, an entirely different platform there. The key message in that would be that what is required is early identification. If possible, then early intervention. And the reason early intervention is so successful is because it's at that point that perhaps maybe parents' alienating behaviours are unconscious. And they can be most easily reversed at that point in time. However, when we've been in the court system a number of times, or when we've been interviewed with social workers and Gardaí a number of times, we progress onto the severe end of the spectrum. When we're in that space, the literature tells us very clearly that when a parent is pathologically determined to erase a child from the other parent, we are likely dealing with a personality disorder in that parent. And what is required in those cases is very firm and proactive decisions by the judiciary to motivate behaviour change in that parent.
Is the judiciary up to it at the moment, do you think? I mean, a lot of people saying here they're not, you know, that the legal system doesn't recognise it properly.
Sure. So in my experience, there are some very, passionate legal practitioners and professionals who really get this. The difficulty is that there's a variety of systemic barriers and challenges that are, getting in the way of effective, tangible change and interventions in this space.
The process that the family law courts have sort of been described as a very slow-moving situation.
They can be, absolutely.
But
again, as I say, it's a system and it's inherently an adversarial system, which in mild to moderate end of the spectrum may not be so helpful. When we get to the severe end of the spectrum, we do need firm court orders, we do need specific court orders, and we need sanctions to be imposed on the alienating parent.
You've mentioned a couple of times early intervention, and we've had a text in here. I share the experiences of many of your contributors. I have been alienated for over a year from my three boys. Brian said that early intervention can help. What does early mean? Is it too late, says this person, after a year or after 2 years?
So I suppose I'll respond to the last point first, if that makes sense. So after a year or 2 years is certainly not too late. I have frequently seen children who haven't seen a parent for in excess of 2 years. And it's an incredible dynamic to watch that once they've been taken out of that loyalty conflict, they can flick as quickly as a light switch. I've seen it happen in less than 20 minutes.
And would these children be young? I mean, would they be teenagers or would they be, you know, still maybe under the age of 12?
As I'm speaking around this particular point, I'm thinking specifically of a pre-teens. Let me give you an example. I was recently working with a six-year-old not in this jurisdiction. And the six-year-old presented as never wanting to see mum ever again. And she was putting out a number of different frivolous rationalisations for that. While she was being observed by dad. Once we arrange for the child to observe dad leaving the room and observe dad leaving the building, and we then introduced mum to this six-year-old, the six-year-old instantly embraced her mother and kissed her and hugged her.
That's really hard to hear, isn't it? That's very emotional to hear, actually, because that's just sad. Mm.
That's the reality of it. And the difficulty is that very often uninformed practitioners will take an idea that, well, it needs to be baby steps and we need to pussyfoot around it. Actually, once we can be clear that there was a previous warm, loving relationship between the child and the targeted parents, actually what's required is proactive, swift actions.
What about teenagers? I mean, just going back to that text, I suppose, you know, is a year too late? Is it 2 years too late? What about teenagers? Are they a bit trickier? Simply by virtue of the fact that they're teenagers and they've got all sorts of other stuff going on. Sure. Do you know, would it be as quick to kind of get back into that familiar relationship?
That's an interesting piece. So teenagers, of course, naturally enough for teenagers, any parent of teenagers listening to me will probably smile when I say that. When parents are going through high conflict separations and divorces, we need to be really, really clear. Are we dealing with alienation or is this child simply being a teenager? And when we can differentiate the two, then we can move forward in an informed way with some certainty. So, for example, teenagers being teenagers, sometimes it can be about differing parenting styles. You know, another classic little piece is that sometimes with teenagers, you know, as children are navigating different developmental milestones, they might regulate distance and closeness between one parent and another. That's not alienation. And so we need to be really, really clear.
Yeah.
If we're in the space of alienation, there's a very clear pathway in terms of identifying, intervening, assessment and intervening that is effective once we have the buy-in from the multidisciplinary buy-in of social, legal and mental health professionals acting in a collaborative way.
I'll just give out the website again, Brian, because so many people are getting in touch with us about this. It was parentalalienation.eu.
Yeah.
So it's a European website, obviously.
Sure.
I'll just say this to you because it just, I suppose, goes to show the damage that can be created by this. My daughter was taken by her father when we divorced in the 80s and alienated me to the ninth degree. She last visited me in 1992. Totally ruined our relationship. Today, she's very messed up. She's a drug addict. My grandson is also a stranger to me.
And regrettably, that particular contributor is alluding to the significant psychological and emotional impacts I referred to earlier.
Yes, yeah. Brian, it's been fascinating having you in this morning and speaking to you and just so many people getting in touch about this. And I just hope that maybe listening to you and giving out those details of that website can help people and help them to get the right help.
Can I also just say that I'm based in the Connolly Centre in Stillorgan?
Yes.
I can be contacted there at 01 2100 600.
There you go. Brian O'Sullivan, consultant, systemic family therapist and expert in what we've been speaking about just now, parental alienation. We'll take a break. Welcome back to the programme. Now, when you think of Ireland and sports, you don't generally think of Cool Runnings, the movie, of course, that John Candy starred in back in the, I'd say it was probably the early 90s maybe, with the Jamaican bobsleigh team. It was a true story, of course, and how they ended up going to the Olympics. But it was a great movie. But you don't necessarily think of that sport when it comes to Ireland. However, you will be very pleased to hear that we do indeed have a potential contender for the next Winter Olympics. That will be in Beijing in 2022. And his name is Brendan Doyle and he's here in the studio with me. Brendan's got a fascinating story. You are currently, Brendan, Ireland's skeleton champion. Could I describe you as that?
You could indeed. I'm the only athlete at the moment, yeah.
You're the only athlete?
Yeah. Just myself.
Well, we'll tell you. You're the champion, so Brendan.
I'll take it.
You've got an interesting story that involves you were a Garda at one point. But let me go back before you joined the Garda Síochána, because you actually got into bobsleighing when you were a teenager.
Yeah. So
how was that? Because I mean, I literally do think Ireland bobsleigh. Where's the connection there?
I actually thought the same. So I started off in track and field. I would train in Morton Stadium in Santry. So I actually got into track and field through my history teacher in St. David's in Artane. And I started then and, you know, I just kept training. And I was a sprinter. And that kind of work really crossed over well into skeleton. And the bobsled team at the time spotted me and they said, do you want to give this a go? And I just jumped at the opportunity and You know,
is that because you were a fast runner?
Yeah,
that's what they need.
Yeah, I'm a small dude, so it kind of works when I'm pushing the sled, because like when you're pushing a skeleton sled, you're kind of bent over, so it just worked for the body type that I have. So you know, I just used my skills from track and field and kind of put them into skeleton.
And so they were, so there was already a bobsleigh team that saw you and thought, we'll have a bit of you. Were they up in Santry as well, or where were they training?
Yeah, they were training in Santry as well. So it was Siobhan and Eva Hoey. They were both training bobsled at that stage.
On what? What were they training at?
Pure Koolanans. It was a bobsled on wheels, and we were pushing it on the track.
Wow.
And that's how I train today. I have a skeleton sled out at the Sports Ireland Institute, and we just push it on the track. That's all I can do right now. So it's kind of how we train in the summer.
So there was no, when this was back when you were a teenager, mm-hmm. you started. So did you ever get the chance to go on ice with it?
Yeah. So a couple of weeks into just dry land training, they took me off to Innsbruck in Austria. And you kind of have to do a driving license. You kind of have to show that you're, because it's kind of a dangerous sport, right?
Yeah.
So you have to prove that you're able to do it. So I went off to Eagles, which is just outside Innsbruck, and I did my skeleton school week. And I remember the first time getting on the sled, they put you down and you're getting ready to go. And I just remember the guy behind me kicking me hard, and he was like, bye-bye, Ireland. And he just kicked me off, and that was my first taste of skeleton. So
scary?
Yeah, terrifying. Yeah.
Yeah. Like being on a roller coaster, or were you screaming all the way down?
Yeah, being on a roller coaster that you can crash on and that you're in control of. Yeah, it's quite kind of intimidating.
How fast do you go? I mean, what's the average kind of speed that you're going when you're in one of those? And is this by yourself when you were doing this?
Yeah, this is by myself. You hit a top speed of 145 kilometres an hour.
Woo!
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fast.
Yeah, you don't feel it at the time because you're so focused on what you're doing. But yeah, it can get pretty gnarly, all right.
And what was that, like if you go back to that very first time then in Austria, when you mm-hmm. got out and when you finished, like when you said you don't feel it at the time, do you feel it afterwards?
Yeah, you're exhausted afterwards. You're shaking and you want to get back up and do it again. But by the time you get back up and do it again, the nerves have set in and you just don't want to do it again. So you just have to train that out of you, really.
So you got your license, as it were. Your
bobsled, driving license.
Your driving license.
Yep.
And you come back. And so how old were you at this point?
I was like 17.
And,
yeah.
And so what was the, you know, was there a next step kind of in the bobsleigh area for you then? Were you going to compete?
Well, the idea was to get a team ready for Turin in 2006. But obviously there was limited funding and there was kind of other older athletes ahead of me. So they were taking the priority. So I was basically said that they said that, you know, you fund it yourself. Or, you know, you can't do it. So I kind of had to kind of focus on my professional goals at that point.
And your professional goals, of course, brought you then to the Garda Síochána.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah.
So
yeah.
You became a guard.
Yeah.
Why did you want to be a guard?
It was a dream job. It was so rewarding. You know, job satisfaction of being able to help and be in a community and be that person to help someone in need. It just draw me to the thing. And obviously there's a bit of action too, but, you know, helping people means a lot to me.
And then you were a guard for a number of years mm-hmm. And something happened.
Yeah, so I was stationed in an inner city Dublin station, and I went into work one day and there was a domestic assault call on hold. Now, these are normally very volatile by nature, and you know, we responded to the call, and when I got to the address, you know, I saw the suspect at the door. Now, the suspect was armed with a wooden baton. And I tried to use my verbal reasoning skills to calm the suspect down and just to reason with them. But obviously that fell on deaf ears, and they actually armed themselves with a chef's knife. And it was during that kind of arrest where I received injuries.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many years had you been in the guards when this happened?
I would have been about a year, just over a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you sustained injuries during that?
Yeah. So
serious injuries?
I mean, there's obviously more serious injuries out there, but it was my hand was cut. So my right thumb, the nerves were severed. And one of my fingers is the ligament was sliced, and it's just constantly in a kind of a 90 degree angle.
I can see, yeah. And your little finger there.
Yeah,
and right hand.
I'm going to need surgery for mm-hmm. the rest of my life, because every time the surgery takes place, the ligament's actually going to shorten again. So I'm just going to mm-hmm. keep needing surgery and skin grafts and so on. So it's something that I'm going to have forever, but I can't really do it now because the rehab time is too long. It'll cut into my training for the Olympics.
That's a very difficult thing to go through, even though I guess as a guard you're presumably prepared that anything could happen at any time.
Yeah.
How were you afterwards? What happened afterwards, despite the physical injuries?
So the physical, like having my background in athletics and training, I was able to cope with the physical side of things. It was normal for me. And I remember getting home that night and, you know, I told my folks I was fine and whatever. And I went to sleep. And that was kind of my last night's sleep for a number of years. The following night, I was woken up to my first experience with a night terror, and it's such a kind of a visceral feeling. I had a dream that the suspect was there with the knife, and my hand was still bleeding, and my bed was covered in my blood, and I woke up having my hand grabbing my other hand, trying to stop the bleeding, and I would get this night in, night out, and I would be violently woken up, and you know, once bitten, twice shy. That's very, very difficult to deal with, being kind of shaken awake. And I kind of started having problems with sleeping, and insomnia started crawling in. So that, for me, I feel the insomnia was the catalyst for everything, not being able to go back to sleep and heal.
You were afraid to go back to sleep, presumably.
I was afraid to go back to sleep because I knew what was going to happen. It was happening night in, night out, and it was just so violent, and I'd wake up and I'd not be able to go back to sleep because, I mean, we've had nightmares before, right? And they kind of stay in your mind for a minute or two and then you're trying to drift back off. You know, I couldn't shake it. I just, and, you know, it ate into my sleep, which ate into everything else and my ability just to be a person.
I'm very lucky. I've never suffered from insomnia, but I've had a few nights of bad sleep. And I know how it can affect you the next day or even that week.
Mm-hmm.
You say that you had, was it about 6 years of insomnia?
Yeah, I would, quote unquote, work off about an hour and a half of broken sleep. So I would be kind of, you know, that when you're waiting for, like, let's say you're flying away and you know you have to be up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you wake up before your alarm. That was kind of that. I was really light sleep. And, you know, I would start feeling like a prisoner in my own room. I was just tossing and turning. I was hyper aware of not being able to go to sleep. You know, 5 minutes felt like 2 hours. And I eventually stopped trying to go to sleep, and you know, in the height of it, I would be driving to Cork and back to fill the nights because I just couldn't.
From Dublin?
Yeah. Just I couldn't lie in my room anymore. I couldn't just like sit there as a prisoner. So I would get in the car. I wouldn't set out to drive to Cork, but I would find myself in Cork and then I'd drive back. That's how I would fill the nights.
Were you talking to anybody at this point? I mean, were you telling people what was going on?
No. There lies one of the issues with mental health problems is, you know, the easiest person to fool is yourself. And I was telling myself, this is fine. This is, you know, a growing pain. This is part of getting back. My body's just trying to digest what's happened. At that stage, no. It wasn't until things kind of pushed along and I tried to get back into work. You know, being from athletics, you get injured, you rehab and you get back as soon as you can. And that's the mentality I brought into work. And we were all sitting in the patrol car one day and we just got this very mundane call, just go out and check a premises. And I remember my collar feeling like it was tightening and the seatbelt pulling me into the chair and my stab vest feeling like just a ton weight. I'm an asthmatic and I thought it was an asthma attack. Mm. So I took my inhaler and it didn't really help. So I went back to my sergeant and he kind of said, you need to really look at what's going on here. So you need to take some time. And
sounds like was it a panic attack?
It was a panic attack, and I've never experienced that before. Like before all of this, I would, you know, I would be sad like everyone else would be sad, but it would never kind of, you know, take over my life. And when I got back on sick leave to try to get better, it just started spiraling out of control and overwhelming feelings of frustration. I was letting my unit down. I felt like I was letting myself down. All my connections with my friends and my girlfriend at the time, that all frayed apart. You know, I stopped doing the things that, you know, gave me hope, like training or eating well. Everything just, you know, fell apart on me. And, you know, depression really, really set in and it really weighed me down. It was so difficult to try to deal with that again without that sleep. And I still to this day believe that, you know, the sleep was the biggest stepping stone for me to try to get around.
Because you had no energy. You had no fresh energy 100%. Every morning or every day to kind of face the problems during the day.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
You describe it so well, and I'm sure there's people listening who have suffered from insomnia, maybe still are, and it just, it sounds horrendous, to be quite honest, and it went on for such a long time for you.
Yeah.
What happened? Where was the turning point?
So much like many stories I've heard in the past, it's at your lowest point you get your turning point. And I got to a stage where, and again, here's like, for me, one of the issues when I was suffering was my ability to, you know, see the options that were ahead of me. And I didn't see there was options. I didn't think there was any hope. So I felt that the only option was to try and take my life, to try to, you know, separate myself from the depression, from feeling like a failure, and that turbulent energy of anxiety and depression and the dreams and stuff like that. So, you know, I was in a position where I felt like that was the only option. And obviously it's not, but when you're not thinking straight, that's what it feels like.
Mm-hmm. You obviously didn't do that.
I got so lucky, yeah.
You were lucky, you say.
Very, very, very lucky. So
came back from the edge.
I got, yeah, absolutely.
When did you get back on a sled?
Oh, 2020. I did a small little bit in 2015, and then it was 2016-17 season where I went full into this.
But was it, you know, was there a period in the dark times where, you know, did anybody say to you, or did you think yourself, maybe I should get back into sledding, maybe I need to get back into doing something active again?
So it was after I had my low point, mm-hmm. that I started to get back into things. I actually went to my friend, and I just talked to him and I said, hey, this is what happened. I'm telling you now because I just want to be held accountable. I just want someone on this planet to know what's going on so I can say, hey, I'm not okay today, and you know what's going on. And he said, just go back to the gym. That's what you know and that's what you love. So I started training again. You know, nothing compared to what I used to do, but just small bits every day. And I eventually got back to the point where I was training athletics. And I had a chance, it was literally random chance run in with the then president of the Irish Bobsled and Skeleton Federation. And he said, you should give it a go. And here I am.
That's incredible.
Lucky times too.
What a good friend you have.
Yeah, absolutely.
What a very
good
friend
amazing.
You have.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, we talk a lot about mental health and about how sharing problems and talking to people close to you helps. And your friend obviously just said something very simple to you.
100%.
Pointed you in the right direction.
He knew me, so. Yeah.
So look, you're on the skeleton. We should point out that you left the guards a couple of years ago, didn't you? You're not a guard anymore.
No, I'm not a guard anymore. You know, I loved the job and I worked hard to get in and I worked hard to stay there. But at the end of the day, I had to look after my mental health. And, you know, it's not something as easy as rehabbing a muscular injury. So I had to just take that step back. And it was a very, very tough decision. But luckily, again, I'm going to bring this back to friends. There's a lot of colleagues in the job who, I mean, they know who they are, but they did massive work to help me realise that this is the best step for me. So, because I'm battling with people outside the job and say, it's a permanent pensionable job, it's this, it's that, and
yeah,
all
of
that.
Of course, of course.
But
yeah.
Inside the job, they're like, your mental health means more than anything.
It does, of course it does. And I suppose, look, particularly a job like that where you are faced with stressful situations on an ongoing basis, on a daily basis.
Daily basis,
and you don't know what you're heading into. It wasn't going to be the right place for you.
No, not at all.
So you're now on a different journey, which involves hopefully heading to the Olympics in Beijing in 2022.
Yep.
Where are you now in the sport, and what sort of training are you doing?
So right now, last Olympic season, I missed out the qualification by a single point. I was so heartbreaking
and
close.
Bloody. And when was this? Was
this? This is February 2018.
Okay.
So
this
is Pyeongchang, and you know, that was a tough month for me. That was another test to see, you know, if I really wanted this. And you know, I picked myself back up and I committed to it. And I'm so glad I did, because last season I had a breakthrough season. You know, I got my first career medal. I broke personal best at every single track I went to. I finished 22nd in the World Championships, and I qualified Ireland for the highest level of competition, which is World Cup, for the first time since 2013.
That's incredible.
So I had
That's
a great
amazing.
Season
yeah.
last year. So
yeah.
I'm trying to work on that now. So where I am right now, I'm training out in the Sports Ireland Institute out in Blanchardstown. I train there full time. And, you know, I'm working on the European Championships and the European circuit this year. And then going into pre-Olympic season, I'll be ready for the Olympic season.
Okay, so it's Beijing 2022 that you've got your eyes set on.
Yeah.
It's your full-time job.
This is, I mean, the margins in sport right now are so narrow that you have to commit everything to it, and I'm all or nothing. So this is what I'm focused on.
What's the funding like? And because we know that sport can be very tricky, and if it's your full-time job, you need support, don't you?
Absolutely. You know, skeleton is like Formula One on ice. It has the price tag along with it. And right now, you know, I have got help from the Olympic Federation of Ireland, but you know, I need so much more help, and I'm doing a lot of work myself trying to form partnerships to bring me through to 2022. And it's very difficult because, again, I'm a one-man band. I'm doing everything myself. So, you know, funding is a massive bottleneck.
You mentioned the Formula One. I'm picturing now, of course, because it is great watching the Winter Olympics, actually. It's fantastic to watch. And the sleds are very slick machines. I mean, do you have your own at the moment?
Yeah, I have my own. It's a Willy Schneider sled. So it's a German built sled. You know,
how much of one of them put you by? Now?
10 grand.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and then the steel. So if you can kind of visualize a tea tray with two kind of metal rods on the bottom, so that's where the rubber meets the road, essentially. Those runners, those steel rods, are about 700-800 a pair, and we need 5 or 6 pairs depending on weather and ice conditions and the track, and there's so many different things. But yeah, the costs amount up really quickly.
Do you have to as well during the season? Obviously, you're on a track now at the moment, but mm-hmm. I mean, do you have to go and get on the ice as well during, you know, during your practice? And is there anything like that available in Ireland for you to practice on?
No, nothing yet. There's push houses in Bath. The British team have really put a lot of funding into this, and they're one of the powerhouses right now. So they have a facility in Bath. Unfortunately, I can't get onto it, but you know, I'm doing what I can, cool running style. I've made my own little track that I put down, and you know, I'll head out to Germany a week or two before the season starts to get some ice post training, and then start training.
When does the season start?
It'll be October, for second week of October.
Okay, so that's the name to remember and the name to watch out for this bobsleigh season is Brendan Doyle, as he, hopefully, the Olympic ambitions, everything comes good for you, because Brendan, your story is incredible. Thank you for sharing
you so
it with us this morning. Beijing 2022.
Let's
I
do
can
it.
See it now.
Let's
I can
do
see it.
It
now, Brendan.
I'll see you there.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. And you know, just because some people might be listening, suffering from things like insomnia, from depression, from mental health issues, we'll always give out the numbers to you. The Samaritans, you can telephone them 116 123. Aware, you can phone them 1800 80 48 48. And Pieta House, of course, they have a website, pieta.ie, and you can call their National Suicide Helpline. It's 1800 247 247. We'll take a quick break. My next guest is an incredible person because she has broken a record, not just any old record, and not just a random record. It was actually this week, at the beginning of the week on Monday. Rachel Lee, she's a firefighter with Dublin Fire Brigade in Phibsborough, D-Watch, and she swam the channel between Northern Ireland and Scotland as part of a 3-person relay team, where other members of the team included her husband. Yeah. Rachel, good morning to you.
Hi, Maggie, how you going? Thanks for having me.
Well, listen, how are you doing?
Good.
Are you sore? Are you tired after
that? A bit tired, but very overwhelmed. I don't think it's really hit home yet, but yeah, so just...
Congratulations
so
on your
much.
World record. 34.5 kilometres from Donaghadee in County Down all the way over to Port Patrick in Scotland.
Yes.
That's pretty incredible. That's a long old stretch of water.
It is. And that's how the crow flies. So really, you swim about 40 kilometres, 45 kilometres because the currents are so strong.
How long did it take you?
It took us 9 hours and 20 minutes.
What was the record before that? What were you trying to beat?
We were trying to beat 9 hours, 34 minutes. But there was a solo person. So that's an American girl called Michelle, who's amazing. Did the whole thing on her own solo. Like, so she's incredible. So we'd like to go quicker than her because there's 3 of us. And then the other, there was a 5-person relay that did it, I think in 2016, in 9 hours, 55. So we just wanted to try and...
Well, you did it.
Yeah,
very
we
well,
did.
Didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, exactly.
And your husband was part of the relay
Tom,
team as well.
Yeah.
And who was the third person?
Ronan Joyce, our friend Ronan Joyce, Big Row, we call him.
Okay, Big Row. Big Row, your husband and yourself.
Yeah.
Why? Why did you want to do this crazy thing?
Well, there's a few things. We're all swimmers. We coach open water swimming with Ocean Breakers, and we're all ex national and international swimmers. We've all done solos at the English Channel, but we said we'd do something together. But also, we also did it as a plastic awareness, because we just can't get over the amount of single-use plastic and what we're finding in our oceans, and it's become really, really worrying. So we just wanted to bring a bit of awareness about that.
Okay, so what was, and how did you get around that then? What did you do? Is that, was that just a, you know, for a charity then, or?
Well, what we did was when I was doing the English Channel, I just couldn't get over when I was training just how much plastic was in the oceans, bottles, cups, plastic bags. I was hitting the face a few times from it, and I just said, okay, this enough is enough. Mm. We've all got young kids. Ronan has twins, I have twins, and we just wanted to maybe have the oceans free for them, because by 2050 there's going to be more plastic than fish in the sea.
That's frightening.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It really is. It really is.
It's fascinating that you see it like in the middle, as you're swimming across a vast open space of water, and you're getting hit in the face by stuff.
Yeah, but mostly you see it on the shore. So when you're going in for training, you see it all on the shore there, because it's been swept in by the currents and tides. So we try and clean up as much as we can, bring awareness to the kids, liaise with Clean Coasts. And we're really lucky to be sponsored by Kingspan, who are trying to get 1 billion bottles collected and recycled to use in their materials. So all this is coming together, and we're just trying to get a lot of awareness out there.
Good for you guys. So listen, you took off, and I know that whenever you do any sort of a big swim like this, the conditions are very important.
Yes. Yeah.
So it happened on Monday. Did you know, when you woke up? Okay.
So we had booked in for a week in July. That's when our pilot from Infinity, Borg, had booked us in to try and do it that week, because you only get a certain window to do it. So by Friday, he said, no, look, it's just not going to happen Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And we knew that we weren't really going to go out then, because that was our chance close. So I was back in work Saturday, got a text on Saturday evening saying possibly might happen, be ready. 11:30 on Sunday, I was in work, I was out in the ambulance. I didn't have my phone on me. And then when I finally got to my phone, because I was actually really busy, I see a text from Kevin, who was on our crew, saying, check your messages, you're going tomorrow morning.
Oh, gosh.
So I had to get home, get up to North and get accommodation, get everything sorted. And the five of us, my mum was on the crew, our friend Kevin.
Take us back now. So you work a really busy shift.
Yeah.
Now, you said you're in the ambulance, but you're with Dublin Fire Brigade.
But we're all paramedics as well. Paramedics, it was my turn to be on the ambulance, yeah.
So you had a busy
day. Yeah, a mad day, yeah.
And then off you go up to the North.
Yeah.
And were you feeling tired?
We were just so nervous, because we didn't know what to expect. We had thought that we weren't going to get up. So we thought, oh, look, maybe the end of August we might get out. So we kind of put out of our minds. We had unpacked everything already. And then we had to get everything back together, get the kids minded. Like I said, we both have twins. Mm. And so it was just, we have a great family support though. But we just got up there and we said, look, you know, you cannot, as my neighbour said, when opportunity arises, you can't say no. So we said, let's go for it.
And I take it then, when you say everything was packed, I take it you did this in like full snorkel gear and wetsuits and flippers.
No, you're only allowed to wear one pair of togs, hat and goggles. One pair of togs, yeah.
So what did you have, a swimsuit on your leg?
Just a normal swimsuit, yeah, and the lads out there. Put your smugglers on them, and that was it, yeah.
Was it cold?
It was freezing.
I mean, you're talking about from the north over to Scotland.
Yeah, well, the whole thing about the North Channel is compared to the English Channel, it's a lot colder. It's really hostile waters. The currents are a lot stronger, and they have a lot of jellyfish, linesmen jellyfish.
Now, tell me about the linesmen. No, well, first of all, take us back to the beginning. So you go out in a boat, first of all.
Yes, so what happens, you have to meet at a little harbour. We met in Bangor, and we had to be, we were actually really lucky with the tides, because normally we might start at 4 a.m. So we had to meet at 6:30. So we got up at 5, you know, get the hot thermoses ready, fill them up with our kettle. And,
did you have a bowl of porridge?
No, I didn't eat anything. No, I don't think any of us ate anything. And so then we went to the drove, had everything packed, drove the two cars to the harbour, unpacked everything, got on the boat. Had to then get the boat then to where it starts in Dunnacadie, and then you wait for 5 to 8, and Tom, who was going first, had to then jump from the boat, swim up to the start, get up on a rock, and then go.
And who was there? Who were the official kind of people who were there checking to make sure that it was
to ratify the swim, you have to have an official from the Irish Long Distance Swimming Association. So a guy named Ian was on the boat, and then our pilot was Charles, and a guy from Sean from Infinity, who we were escort vessel and sure.
So when you said Ronan was the first one in, or Tom?
No, Tom,
Tom was
in,
the first one in. So when he went in then, was the boat following really close to him?
Yeah, he's right beside the boat.
Okay.
So the boat guides you and you swim.
And were you talking to him?
No. We don't talk at all when we swim.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No.
Okay.
We didn't stop. So there are transitions. So when Tom is coming up to his hour, so I'd be at the side of the boat. And
so each of you swim for an hour at a time.
An hour at a time. Mm-hmm. Now we're in, 2 hours out. And the rapid fire would say, right, 30 seconds. I'd stand at the end and he'd go 3, 2, 1. And I would jump in or dive in, swim past Tom, keep swimming, and he'd go to the back of the boat to get up a ladder.
Okay. And so you did an hour in the water swimming, constantly swimming.
Yeah, constantly swimming.
Okay. And then you're 2 hours in the boat. And
shivering,
then,
freezing.
I was going to say, the 2 hours in the boat then, what are you doing?
Well, the first hour, it was convulsions for about an hour, really, really cold. And then it was great. We had two crew members with us, Kevin and my mum. So they were like just getting stressed, getting us warm. So I just sit there, try and get warm. And then you're thinking, oh my God, I was actually praying an orca would eat me because I was just so miserable after the first hour. And then you just have to get ready to go back in again.
But it's interesting that you say you don't talk. So like are you not kind of thinking about the guy who's in the water? Are you thinking I should be giving him a little bit of...
No, because there's like someone else sitting there. So Rowan, when I was swimming, Rowan was watching me. And then when Tom was swimming, after an hour, I'd go and watch him. You'd just be giving the thumbs up.
Okay,
that was
right.
It, you know, but you wouldn't talk. No,
okay.
Because if you lose your stroke rate, you'll
So 9 hours, 20 minutes. I can't figure out the maths quickly enough. So how many times were you in then?
I was in three times.
Three times, okay.
And Tom was in four times.
And like when it came to the third hour then that you did?
Third hour was the best hour.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Because you knew.
You could see Scotland. Right. The sun was on our back and it was really, really choppy.
Okay.
So we loved the chop. So,
oh, why? Why was the choppy easier?
Oh, we just like the chop. It just kind of gets your head away from everything. And you, when I was choppy, I felt like the lion's mane were lower below me. They wouldn't come up high. So,
right, yeah. So the jellyfish, we've got to talk about the jellyfish, the lion's mane.
Yeah.
Not tiny little jellyfish. I mean,
no, they're huge.
Big
colossal.
Lads. Right.
Colossal.
How many jellyfish
were
around?
Well, I heard before
you?
There'd be like thousands. And I was going, oh, come on, there's just no way. And when Tom was in first, what happens is the guy at the top of the boat with a whistle, and he blows a whistle, and you'll hear the whistle, and he puts your head up, and he'll go left or right. That means you go swimming left or swim right.
He's blowing the whistle to tell you about the jellyfish.
Yeah, that he can see at the top. So you kind of swim past them. But when you're swimming down, and I look down, I could not believe there's just thousands of them. And they're coming from all different angles, all different colours. Oh my God, it was
How
just...
How did that not put you off? I mean, let me tell you, I would have been screaming and then I would have been drowning and then I would have been screaming.
There was a few screams and we did get stung quite a lot, but listen, it's all in your head and we just wanted to do it.
Were the stings sore?
Yeah, yeah. And Tom and Rowan both got stung in their face. I was lucky, I was just stung on my arm and leg, so yeah.
And are you scarred like or anything?
No, it was grand. It takes about 24 hours and it just gets really kind of hot. But when you got back in the water, actually, the salt water is really good for stings, so it kind of cooled it down again, so...
Right, okay. So that was the jellyfish.
Yes.
And then it turns out, there was an orca following you.
Yes. Well, I don't know if following us, but there was a photo put up that they didn't tell us at the time. There was drones out and they were keeping an eye on the orca. And there was one behind us in the fifth hour when I was in the water. And we have photos of it breaching and it's just amazing.
So the fin is up above.
Yeah.
And it's kind of...
Yeah,
it's
and they can swim like 24 knots, 30 knots. They're so fast. So they would just... But they eat herring, so hopefully.
Okay, but so you had no idea that this orca,
no,
this
and the
huge
pilots did.
Fish was
Yeah. And just as well, they didn't tell us because you just don't want to know those kind of
and
things.
And the lads on the boat knew, but,
the pilot,
but not the swimmers.
Yeah.
My goodness. But that's an incredible photo,
isn't it?
To have.
Yeah, it is. It is cool.
You know, that you're there in the water and this big fin is behind you.
I know. And our kids think we're pretty cool.
Of course they do. How old are the kids?
Bruce and Lex are 6 and Anna and Rena are 9.
And they're delighted.
Delighted, yeah.
Proud of mammy and daddy.
Oh, they are, yeah.
The challenge is incredible. And the fact that you were doing it to highlight so many important issues as well.
Yes.
How are you feeling now? I mean, you broke the record, which is obviously great. Did they tell you straight away then that you'd done it? Obviously they knew.
Yeah, they have to ratify it. But once we were up, we knew, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did you do in Scotland when you got off the boat?
Well, when you get to Scotland, you climb up on the rock and you have to be all go, yay. And then my mum and Kevin swam in with us as well. That was great. Then you got to jump off the rock, get back on the boat. And it was brilliant because the boat was so fast. We were back in Bangor in an hour and a half.
Oh, fantastic.
So that was it. Yeah, you don't do it in
and
Scotland.
And did you have a bit of a celebration that night?
We went straight back to where we were staying and we had dinner and a few drinks. Yeah, but we were all wrecked in bed by 12.
I was going to say,
yeah.
You deserved the early night. What's it like? You said that you swim anyway. Like, do you swim on a daily basis in the sea?
Yeah, we swim every day.
Where do you swim?
I swim the aquatic centre in Blanchardstown and we swim in the sea in the summertime as well. So we juggle it around work. It's really hard to juggle with kids and everything, so it's early in the morning or late at night, so it's not interfering in their time.
Husband is also a firefighter?
Yes, yeah.
And Ronan is a firefighter?
Yeah. No, Ronan works in IT. Yeah.
He works in IT. Yeah. Okay, fantastic. If people are kind of thinking, I'd like to do something like that, I'd like to swim from Northern Ireland to Scotland.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a really good swimmer, and like you said, you were a professional swimmer at one point. I mean, would you have to be that sort of level to take on something like this?
Well, you want to have a lot of mileage and you want to be well, especially for the North Channel. You want to have a lot of preparation done, acclimatisation, and mental health is just really, really important. And know that you want to do it. But yeah, to take on any channel, I believe anyone, if they really want to do it, they can do it. But you want to put in years of work.
Fantastic.
Years and years.
Listen, Rachel Lee, well done to you. And
you're off work for a few days now. Back in on Friday. Yeah.
Back into Phibsborough, D-Watch, Dublin Fire Brigade on Friday. Yeah. Good for you. A world record holder now. Congratulations after swimming the channel between Northern Ireland and Scotland. Rachel Lee, well done to you, your husband Tom Healy, and Ronan Joyce as well. We'll take a break.
Thanks so much.
Now, joining me this morning is a young woman with a first-class attitude to life. Sarah O'Neill, good morning, and you're very welcome into the studio.
Thank you.
Sarah, I hate talking about ages, but I will tell everyone that you're 22 now.
Yeah.
But I want you to take us back to when you were 17 and the summer before you're leaving cert, and you're in school, and what happens? You're in fifth year.
So I had just finished for the summer and I was having pain for a few months, and it was going on for about 5 or 6 months, and my mum had always said, do you need to go into the hospital? And I was like, no, it's fine. And then one night I was in bed and I couldn't breathe, and I was like, right, there's something wrong here. So I text her, and I was like, we need to go to the hospital tomorrow. And she says, no, we're going now. So we got up, went to the hospital, and within kind of about a week or so, I was diagnosed with cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Wow. Yeah. That's a pretty serious diagnosis to get at 17. What happened? Like, do you remember being told those words? Was your mum with you?
Yeah, we were. So I live in Drogheda. So I went into Drogheda, and then I was transferred to the Mar, and had kind of, they knew there was something bad. They told my mum and dad, but didn't tell me. And I was kind of like looking around like, oh yeah, I'm grand. Don't know what's going on. But then one day they sat me down and they were like, there's something wrong. We don't really know what it is. So I had all the tests and stuff. And so by that point I was in the matter. And I remember one day it was me, my mum, my dad, my nanny, and the consultant and her nurse came in, and they were like, you have cancer. And I was like, what? Me? I'm too young. Like, I didn't even think people that were that young could get sick. Like, and it was really surreal. Like, I really remembered that point. A lot of my treatment and kind of the year after is a bit of a blur, but I really remember sitting in the room. Like, I remember everything about it.
Still now.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah.
I suppose it was a real shock. I mean, that's probably why it's stuck in your head, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, completely. Mm. It was like the last thing I was expecting.
So you're supposed to be heading into sixth year, mm-hmm. but instead you have to start getting treatment.
Yeah.
And what happens? Like, what sort of treatment did you get? Did you have to have an operation?
Yeah. So I was diagnosed on the Monday, and I started chemo on the Wednesday, because it was so, the pain had been there, the tumour was so big. So started treatment on the Wednesday. That went on for about 6 months or so. And then I had surgery, the tumour was in my chest. So I had surgery to remove what was left there. But what they removed, there was still like traces of lymphoma. So I had radiotherapy then to kind of zap in, make sure it doesn't come back.
And, you know, I suppose at that time where a lot of friends around, and it's probably, you know, it's summertime mm-hmm. in school. So was there a lot of stuff going on that you were missing at the time? And were your friends in and out to see you and visit you?
Yeah, I think you really learn kind of who is there for you. And I looking back, I know, like, you're so young, you don't think that's not where they are. You know, they don't think, oh, you...
And it's hard, I think, isn't it?
I do understand looking back. But I remember there'd be days, and like one of my friends, she was like, it was a real sunny day and I was in hospital, and she says, she was supposed to come up, and she said, everyone's going to the beach today, so I'll come up tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's normal.
It was probably very hurtful for you, mm-hmm. of course, at the time, but probably normal.
Yeah. She, like, no one thought any day, like, looking back now, I don't think any different of it. Like, it's fine.
How long did you have to have chemotherapy for?
About 6 months. So I had it as an inpatient.
Were you in hospital for the whole time, or did you go in and out?
I would go in and out. Mm-hmm. So I was in for about 5 days, and then I'd go home for 2 weeks. But I was in twice a week over them 2 weeks for like bloods and checkup.
And how did you feel? Were you sick with it?
I wasn't too bad. I was never sick, but I had like joint pain and I was really tired all the time. My mom still made sure I got out of bed every day and done something. So I was in a good frame of mind the whole time.
You you mentioned your mom a few times and there's a lovely picture. It was journalist Elaine Keogh that mm-hmm. you spoke to and your picture was in the paper yesterday with your mum and your dad, and a gorgeous picture yeah. actually attached to the article. And you've got beautiful long black hair. It's really gorgeous. But at the time, of course, you lost your hair through the chemo.
Yeah.
And what did your mum do to help you?
We both shaved our heads together. Yeah, in hospital. She says it wasn't even an option. She was always going to do it.
Did you know beforehand? Like, did they tell you that?
They told me I was going to lose it, yeah. And my dad had said, do you want to shave it? And I was like, no way, definitely not. And then I sat in bed and I was thinking, like, do I want to lose it? And I think it was the only thing I could control. So I was like, I told him to come in and I was like, no, I'll shave it. So
had it started to come out?
Yeah. No. It was very, like, oh, I done it really early. It came out about a week later. It had started to kind of grow back, but by the end of my treatment, like, I didn't have a hair on my head. I didn't even have nose hairs. It was really weird.
Your mum shaved her head as well.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that make you feel, your mum doing that?
I don't know. At the time, it was weird because we were in hospital for about 3 weeks. So it was fine. We were walking around and it was normal. And then I got discharged and she was like, we have to go out into the real world now. Yeah. What are we going to do? So it was strange, just the two of us walking around with no hair.
And did you cover it with you know, scarves or anything like that? Or?
I had a few scarves. I had wigs, but I didn't, like, I wasn't into it. I didn't mind walking around with no hair. It didn't really, now I saw people looking, but like, I would probably look at somebody if I saw them.
I suppose when you're 17 mm-hmm. and, you know, when things like, I suppose, maybe clothes and hair is important
yeah,
to you.
Yeah.
You can't, you're saying, like, the way you're talking about it is though it wasn't that, you know, important. And was that, mm-hmm. is that because, I suppose, were you going in and out of hospital so much and you were having so much other stuff going on with you?
I think so, yeah. Because I would still, like, I still get caught up in what I look like now. And then I look back and think, I didn't even think about how I looked then. And like, and I was happy in myself. So why am I getting so, you know, it puts everything into perspective for me. And I don't get too caught up in it.
You said that by the end of your treatment, you didn't have any hair at all.
No.
When did it start coming back then?
About 2 or 3 months after I finished treatment. So like, a year after I was diagnosed, I had like a boy cut.
And what about your mum's hair?
Hers was, she kept it short.
Did she?
So she grew it, like, she grew it kind of like a pixie cut mm-hmm. and kept it that way for a good while.
What's incredible here, Sarah, is that this is all going on. You're in and out of hospital having chemotherapy, and yet you went back and did your leaving cert.
Yeah.
So it was halfway through sixth year, really, that you were still having chemo and yet you were still able to study. You were still able to do some homework.
I wouldn't say that. I would have been good in school before. And the hospital had asked me, do I want to defer? But I knew that if I did, I wouldn't go back. I wasn't mad about school. So I was doing all higher level. I said, I wanted to do a PLC when I finished. So I said, look, I'll just drop to ordinary level. Go in, do it, see what happens. I wasn't expecting much. So
did you go into school at all during sixth year?
Any day I could go in, I went in, but it was days like a trip or, you know, when there was something on. Other days I didn't really bother because I was missing so much mm-hmm. that it didn't, or I was in hospital or there was just so much going on that.
But by the time it comes around to June and the leaving cert starts, you actually sit and you actually take the exams yourself. Like, that's incredible to think that even though you're completely detached from school, you haven't been going in and out, you haven't been doing any of the study, you go in and you sit your Leave and Cert exam.
Yeah. I don't even know how, like, and to pass, I don't know how it happened.
Yeah, you passed.
Yeah.
You got a couple of 100 points. Yeah, I mean, incredible. Yeah. But do you remember sort of taking the exams? Were you at this point, had the chemotherapy finished by the time it came around to the summer?
Yeah, I had the chemotherapy finished. I had the surgery finished. And then, so between the surgery and the radiotherapy, I'd done my Leave and Cert. Yeah, I just kind of went in and done it. I say, it was kind of a break from all the other madness that was going on around it.
So it was like almost a distraction for you?
Yeah.
I mean, that's incredible because, you know, when I think back to my Leave and Cert, and I'm sure other people have been doing the Leave and Cert, it is the big focus. It is the one thing. So do you think it was good for you to do then, looking back?
Yeah. It made, I don't get too caught up in stuff now. I knew at the time that it was my best and I knew that I had tried my best. So I think going forward, I always knew that once I was doing what I knew I could, that was enough.
And then you ended up getting your points. Did you go on and do your PLC course?
Yeah, I done pre-nurse and I originally thought I wanted to be a nurse, but I was more into the theory side of it. Mm-hmm. So I went and done health and society in DCU.
And you have now got your first class honours degree from DCU and you will be graduating in November this year. Sarah O'Neill, fantastic. I mean, how, you know, going back and doing your degree, did you say to people when you met them on the degree course, you said, by the way, you know, I had cancer, to have chemo when I was having my leaving.
When I look back the first day in DCU, everyone was adding people on each other on Facebook. And I actually went onto my Facebook page and like deleted or untagged the photos of me when I was sick. And then now by second year, kind of everybody knew it had come out in some way. But now I look back and I go, why did I feel like I had to do that? But it's not like a conversation that you have with people. Like, I'm quite open about it, so a lot of people know. But when you go to a new place, you don't just say, oh, hi, by the way. So it was weird, but I don't think I do that again. Like, I'm comfortable enough now to, if someone saw, I'm doing a personal training course and like I have my Instagram and stuff and people would follow me and they just know because I post about it, you know.
But it's totally understandable, I think, why you wouldn't want that to be your defining, you know, thing.
Yeah.
That you don't want to be, oh, cancer survivor or I had cancer, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's totally understandable.
Yeah.
How was the degree? Was it a couple of years, the degree course?
3 years.
3 years.
Yeah.
And how did you find it?
I loved it.
And how was your health all the way through that?
It was good. I'd still struggle now, pain and, you know, just the side effects from it all. And I suffer quite bad with fatigue, I find. Sometimes, especially when I'm coming up to exams or assignments and stuff. But overall, I'm quite good. It's hard because you don't really, I think anybody that has kind of had cancer will understand, you get a pain and you're thinking, oh, what's that? You know, is that just a headache or is that something else? And it's kind of knowing how to look out and differentiate between the two.
Because would you be worried that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't, my mom knows, if I tell my mom something, she knows it's bad. Because I keep everything else, like if I'm sick or don't feel well. So she knows when I tell her that it's serious.
Do you go back for checkups?
Yeah, I'm 6 months now still. Every 6 months.
Mm-hmm. And what's the long term then? I mean, will it continue to be every 6 months or will that eventually go to 12 months?
Yeah, it will push out. I think because I had so much treatment, some of my scans show activity, but it's just not like it's expected. So they're still keeping a close eye. Eventually it will kind of be a year. Because I had radiotherapy on my chest, I will probably go into breast screening in the next few years.
Earlier than women normally would. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But that's a good job because that'll keep an eye on you.
Yeah.
We should point out, you mentioned there that you're doing fitness training, that you're actually working at the moment as a personal fitness trainer.
Well, just about to start.
Okay, just about to start. Good, good. And that you were actually very fit and healthy before you got the cancer. Were you quite sporty or was it fitness that you were into?
No, I was never good at sports. I tried everything and never, but I always loved the gym. I done classes. And I was, before I got sick, I was in the gym 3 or 4 times a week. And fell out of it while I was going through treatment and stuff, and it took me about a year or two to get the confidence to go back. I'm there now 2.5 years, and yeah, I just love it.
And would you go to the gym every day now, or
most days?
Would you?
Yeah.
Why do you want to be? Why do you want to go into fitness training? You know, why do you want to help people?
I always wanted to do it before, and then I think now, just seeing how much it has helped me, like I feel the strongest I've been mentally and physically, and I would put it down to exercising and, you know, looking after myself. And I think that sometimes people forget how good you can feel and should feel. So I kind of want to share that.
And so the degree then is obviously helping you, and it's backing you up with that. So you've done the health and science degree from DCU. So you're hoping to kind of combine the two. And is that what you're going to do now for your career?
So the health and society degree it's, I think, about a holistic view of health, that it's not just one thing, or and how to look after yourself, and like it's so broad, and there's so many things that should be taken into consideration, as well as, you know, being active, going out, even and doing something that you enjoy. Like, not everybody wants to sit in the gym, not everybody wants to go for a run, but finding what you like that is your time to for yourself.
You and I don't want to sound in any way, I don't know how I want to sound, but Sarah, you're 22 and you have a very mature head on your shoulders. And I just think of myself as a 22-year-old, you know. And look, and I wasn't able to put myself together like you are able to describe and talk about feelings and mental health and physical health. Were you like that before, do you think, or did the cancer and what you went through make you change your perspective or have a different perspective on life?
Yeah, I was a little bit. I'm the oldest, so I think I did have a little bit of that in me, but definitely when I got sick, and even the whole thing with my friends and, you know, school and my future, it just put everything in perspective for me. And yeah, I definitely grew up. People are like, I look like I'm 12 and I act like I'm 40.
That's not a bad day. Actually, no, you want it the other way around, don't you? No, you do. You want to look, mature. Mature. That's right. Be mature in your head, but look young. And I hope that continues for you, Sarah. I'm sure it will, because like you've got such a good, healthy perspective. Yeah. But you said you're the eldest. So how many younger brothers?
Two younger brothers.
And was that difficult for them then, watching you being sick?
Yeah.
What's the age difference there?
So I'm 22. One of my brothers is 19 and the other is 11. So it was hard for the 11-year-old, Luke. He kind of didn't really understand it. I remember when I came home and I had no hair, all his friends on the road were like, is that contagious? Like, is my hair going to... Yeah. So they didn't. But he was very good still. Like, he did understand. Like, he didn't understand, but he knew there was something. Mm. So he was really good to me. My other brother, I think he struggled as well. He's a runner. So he would just go on 2-hour runs a day. I think that's how he got
through. That's how he struggled. Listen, yeah. Sarah, it's fantastic to hear your story. And thank you so much for coming in this morning. Gladys has just been on touch on a text. Sarah is an inspiration. Mm. Strong girl. Well done.
Thanks very much.
And yeah, indeed, we agree with that. Yeah. I'll just give out a couple of lines just in case people are affected by anything we talked about. The Irish Cancer Society, their free phone is 1-800 200 700. And the Childhood Cancer Foundation, another good one as well, 01-554-5655. And of course, all the helplines are on our website, rte.ie. Sarah, best of luck with the fitness.
Thank you.
And I hope it goes well. And I look forward to seeing a graduation photo maybe of you in November.
Yeah.
We'll take a quick break.